You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Free Speech Radio News airs every Friday at 5 p.m. on WEFT Community Radio, followed by Smile Politely, coming up next. Stay with us after that for, we'll have pre-programmed music from 6 to 8. Our rhythm and blues and hip-hop people couldn't make it in this evening. That will be followed by Blues Live at 8 p.m. and the Bachelor Pad at 10 p.m. So now we'll go to this week's edition of Smile Politely Radio.
You are listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local. Arts, culture, food and drink, music opinion, tech, and more. I'm Rebecca, and this is from a pre-recorded conversation I had with Scott Schwartz, archivist for music and fine arts at the U of I, and director of the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music. Scott started by telling me about how the Sousa Archives acquired almost 75% of Sousa's materials.
You're Sousa. You're a legend. You almost walk on water. All right, everyone loves your music. You die, and you might fall into the trap that Victor Herbert did, where suddenly his entire collection of music is sold piecemeal, and people begin to forget who he is. He wants to be remembered, and so he needed several things. He needed a person that knew how to play the music properly, Harding. He needed a band equal to his own. Now, that's not, you know, a glowing remark on the Illinois program. We have correspondence numerous times. Mm-hmm. Sousa was just impressed with the Illinois band sound. It was extraordinary. It was huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a very rich sound. And so you've got a band and you got a leader and you just need a place to put it. And a gentleman's agreement, that's probably the best way to describe it, to keep his legacy alive. Mm-hmm. And so when the music came here, this building didn't exist. I call it, you know, the previous building was a Quonset hut, but a Harding band member took me to task for that. It was a real problem building. And when they built this, Harding established a Sousa library and a Sousa museum. Mm-hmm. And that was his goal, to ensure that the stuff would be displayed, heard, and played consistently for generations on. And that's, in essence, how the stuff landed here in 32. Mm-hmm. It's gone through several iterations. I think we're closest to what Harding and Sousa were expecting. Although, if you were to say, was he expecting the fact that Sousa's Stars and Stripes is sitting 5 aisles away from Harry Parch's music and entirely 20th century stuff, that I'm sure Sousa would probably, you know, just be rolling his grave on. Such is life.
I asked Scott to talk about the significance of Sousa in the landscape of American music.
We often think of Sousa today as the March King. That's what he was referred to often. Not because the band marched always. They were a concert band. But he wrote many marches, and those became the encore pieces. So in essence, when you went to a concert of Sousa's music, you got a program, and he'd had 5 pieces listed on a program. And they'd all be symphonic pieces, Wagner, Tchaikovsky, Sibelius. And then after each one of those kind of, you know, high art pieces, he would then throw in 1, 2, 3 encore pieces, usually his marches, to juice up the audience. And it was not uncommon for people to get so excited, because it was hard to keep your feet still, they'd start dancing in the aisleways. So you begin to have kind of this early version of a mosh pit, you know, for Sousa concert. And we laugh now about that, but literally, I mean, it was a sound that was extraordinary.
Scott played me one of Sousa's marches, The Fairest of the Fair.
Sousa wrote this after seeing a pretty young lady at the Boston Food Fair where the band was playing. Obviously, the young lady caught his attention. It's a great march.
overview of the main non-Sousa items that people can find at this archive.
Okay, well, I guess anchoring, all right, we have four collecting areas that we focus on. Wind band music with, of course, Sousa forming the core. Then we have electronic and computer music. The university is, okay, the birthplace of computer music. And we have extraordinary collections, the Saul Martorano, the James Beauchamp collections. Saul Mar construction is Salvatore Martorano's incredible music instrument that's designed to improvise music in real time using the TTL boards of the Iliac II, which was also built here. And you've got Beauchamp's harmonic tone generator, one of the very first voltage control oscillators. So, you know, clearly emphasizing the electronic pieces. Then we have ethnomusicology. Bruno Nettle's been here for many, many years. I'd like to think, and he would strongly argue against this comment, you know, Bruno being the father of American ethnomusicology, you know, he would just roll his eyes and say no. But the gist of it is we have a large portion of his papers showing how the ethno program was developed here at the University of Illinois. And then we have the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music, an extraordinary collection. And we have many smaller collections focusing on the nature of world music and its connection here at the university. And finally, local music. Champaign-Urbana had such a vital, and continues to have such a vital music scene. You know, we're focusing on the bands that came from here, the musicians that started here and went off. We mentioned Alison Krauss. It was last Friday. We had a gentleman I do a lot of work working with. He came in with early photographs. He was a photographer of her first recording release when she's 14. We have the Pogo Studio recordings, a very significant body of stuff. We have the Poster Children collection. That was a really hot band in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's all of that just, bringing together that milieu of great music here. I think the most important thing is we got collections, and everybody thinks of archives and museums as the places where you keep the unwashed, unless you have a PhD after your name, you can't touch this stuff. That's not the case. Everyone with a reasonable request has access to the stuff. And for those music instruments that we have in our collection that are still playable, we will let people play. Now, granted, if I have a flute player who wants to play Herbert L. Clark's Coronet, I'm likely to probably say no, because you don't know how to play it. But we just had the Scottish band here about a month ago. It was great. We had a bunch of brass players, and so I brought out a lot of Clark's horns. And, they were really reticent to touch the instrument, figuring, okay, Scott's wearing the gloves. He needs to, he should be the only one touching them. Mm-hmm. And I finally asked who was the principal cornetist in the band, and they point to this lady, and they hand the gloves to her, and says, "Well, crap, I can't play this horn. You play it." And her first instinct was, "Well, this is an old horn. It'll be stuffy, not as good as my modern horn." And it weren't but more 5 seconds. She did two arpeggios and a quick scale, and her eyes got really big, and she says, "Wow, this plays so much better than I expected. How old is this?" Yeah. And suddenly she started playing tunes of the time on the instrument. I mean, we wanted them to really get engaged with it. And it's no different if we had fourth grade class here on campus, and they were studying acoustics, wanted a tour. And so we spent 2 hours talking about the acoustics of music instruments. We played bowed water glasses. I played a tuba. We played a monochord. They understood all of the principles mathematically. And then we went to the harmonic tone generator, and we started talking about the partials that mm-hmm. this device produced. My young kids are now graduate students beginning to do the math and understand how things work. And I was like, yes. And they eventually did an entire exhibition in their, it was across campus, and showing people what they had learned from here. And it was great. It was, I confess, I was quite impressed. So again, letting them play the instruments, engage with the stuff, opens up their minds. And they were asking some really hard questions that I don't get out of my graduate students sometimes. So the whole point, connecting people, giving them the opportunity to ask the questions. Mm-hmm. And then they come back.
So how did you get into this line of work?
Simply put, when I was doing my master's degree at Michigan State, my final thesis was on the 16 Barbara Allen variants in the Lewis Watson Chapel ballad collection. These were recordings made in the 30s, and I did an extensive analysis, and I then started my PhD. Well, let's put this back. The ballad collection was at West Virginia University. And when I was finishing my master's, I was enticed to apply, and I was accepted to get in the PhD program for ethnomusicology there. The folks in the archives heard, okay, you've got a graduate assistantship and so forth. Would you like to work here? And my first question was, what do you want me to do? I know nothing about archives. And so they said, well, you just do what you were doing for your master's, that you keep transcribing those tunes for us. Mm. You're going to pay me now to do what I did, master's. Yeah. And so I did that for 3 years and was really intrigued by it. My teaching assistantship appointment was ending, and they said, well, how about we hire you full-time as kind of an archival technician? And remember at the interview, I said, how long does it take you to become a professional archivist? I'm kind of curious. And George Parkinson basically said, about 10 years of careful, studious work and study and so forth. And I looked at him thinking, no way in hell am I going to take 10 years to figure out how to do this. He kind of laughed. Part of my job at that point was that two nights a week I had to manage the reserve library downstairs. George taught all of the archives classes. Oh, he had all of his reserve readings there. So on the first night, I opened up the top drawer and started with A. At the end of the year, I had gone through four drawers of his readings. And I figured, I get the principles pretty good. So there was a position at East Tennessee State University opened up looking for a professional archivist. And so I just applied for it. Figured they could only say no. And they hired me as their archivist, taking care of the music collections. Kind of pissed George off that it takes him 10 years. He eventually got over that. And I've been doing it ever since. I spent 2.5, what was it? I spent 2 years at West Virginia working as kind of a technician. Tennessee, I was there for 5. At that point, I had kind of mapped a direction. The next job was going to be for 10 years and an opening at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. They needed an archivist who had music background to take care of the Ellington collections. And so I was hired for that because of my jazz background. And I spent 10 years there. And, I wasn't going to be in charge of a national archives. And this position opened up, and this gave me an opportunity to do a couple things. One, create a center for American music. We spent nearly 8 years trying to create a center for American music at the Smithsonian. It was kind of like spitting in the wind. not real. I mean, it was very hard. Couldn't get the administration to move on it. And so when I came here, they asked me to tell them how to build a center for American music here, and I gave him a blueprint. I remember my colleague across the street, when he put me on the plane, he says, if we like your design, we're going to hire you away from the Smithsonian. And I kind of laughed at him and says, yeah, cold chance. obviously, I had change of heart. And we built the center just as we had envisioned it at the Smithsonian. And the guys there still know it. We've done numerous exhibitions of Smithsonian things that I've curated. there and brought here, and we continue to work collaboratively. You know, God, it's what, 14 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, a center that engages people with our stuff. That's my ultimate goal. You know, the place is too damn quiet, and we need to always have music playing somewhere. Otherwise, you know, it's just silence, and it kind of does a disservice to the art.
That makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, I think so, but there are a whole lot of administrators don't quite get it until they've come and visited. So,
So could you describe with specific detail a couple of the, or a few of the items in the collection here that are particularly fascinating to you, particularly unusual or unexpected, perhaps to people who don't know very much about the history of American music?
Well, everything new that comes in is a marvel. And maybe that's just the kid in me. Sound recording technologies. We have a wonderful, albeit small, collection of sound recording technologies. We have the 1899 Columbia Q cylinder player. And it's extraordinary because it is a very crude-looking like device, but is quite capable of performing wonderful music. And then we go to Mr. Harding's Victrola and play that. That's 1920. So literally we can walk through three decades of early sound recording technology and listen to what I refer to as my beater discs or cylinders, so that we aren't playing my preservation copies, and you can put your ears around the sound. And it's stunning because, one, you read the textbooks and they refer to this music of this time as crude. Mm-hmm. Now, I was always puzzled by that. It was crude. Why the hell did everybody buy this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Reality isn't crude. The writer of the book was kind of stupid. it's literally, you just have to take your modern ear set out of your head for a moment and look at the technology and remember at that time, there was no music. You had to make it yourself. Now we got something that can make, mechanically produce it. And you can watch it. And then we talk about the properties of the different technologies and how those sounds are captured. So we can talk technology, we can talk acoustics, we can talk marketing. I mean, there are so many different angles that one can look at. I could do 5 lectures in one day with the same 3 pieces, the same 3 tunes. And I'd have repeat students coming from one to the other.
Because mm-hmm.
it's just a different way to look at the object.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Solmar construction. The device built from those TTL boards. It's extraordinary because I never know what to expect. It literally is a different... It produces different music each time. So when I turn it on, it's my greatest fear. I mean, there are times when I turn it on and it gives me nothing. That's usually when I break out in a cold sweat. And then I usually figure out what's going on. And there are other times it produces very cool things and I want to latch onto it and it's gone. And they said, make it do that again. I said, I can't. And so,
that's the improvisational.
Yep, the improvisational instrument.
Uh-huh.
And it's extraordinary because I'll have engineering students. I think a bulk of the marching band are engineers, and so they understand the technology. How is it possible that we can get this kind of sound from this? And then mm-hmm. they look at the diagrams and begin to understand the logic behind the device. The Solmar actually has functionality that some of the coolest software now still doesn't have.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it is. And so that's what makes it very exciting. And we'll have composers who will spend weeks playing it, working on a new composition using this old piece of technology
mm-hmm.
to create new stuff. And I think that's the ultimate goal. The old stuff can be reused to create new stuff. And that's the life I think Sousa wanted to keep.
Yeah.
He doesn't want you to... He didn't want the band to play the stuff exactly like he did. If he did that, you know, buy one of the damn records.
Right,
begin to grow with it. And so that's our ultimate goal.
Before I left, Scott played me some of the Solmar Construction improvisational instrument.
It's a lot more fascinating if I have about 10 more minutes to set it up. Right now, you're just catching it as it just goes.
You've been listening to Smile Politely Radio. SmilePolitely.com is the place to go for all things local. Arts, culture, food and drink, music, opinion, tech, and more. Have a great weekend.
Tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This has been the WEFT Courier for Friday. Join us for the WEFT Courier every day for Democracy Now! At 4 p.m., followed by two additional programs of information and analysis. Coming up next, we'll have a mixed